visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first global fintech podcast and radio show. This is Rachel Morrissey. I am the senior producer, and for our final show of the year, I decided to share with you two of our favorite interviews. 2016 has been an incredibly eventful year. With the Brexit vote and the American election, we are in the middle of historical trends that will affect how, what, where, and why certain technologies are fostered and others are ignored. Here at the show, we make it a point to be hopeful about the future. Technology isn't good or bad, but how we use it can be. And fintech can be a great force for good. It was just reported that 194,000 Kenyan households have lifted out of poverty because of the adoption of mobile money. Fintech is being applied to everything from aiding refugees to creating transparency of transaction to making it cheaper to send money to loved ones. With that in mind, I chose two interviews today that exemplify our hope for the future. I hope they will inspire those working in the industry and give all of our listeners insight into what is possible.
And so this is why we've got two great guests on the show today. We have Bruce Cahan. He's an adjunct professor at Stanford School of Engineering, where he's co-founded Stanford's Sustainable Banking Initiative. It's interesting that that's in the engineering school. And he's also organizing an independent teaching hospital bank called the Good Bank. Good Bank. And his current projects range from designing how we will bank in space to improving interfaith banking and investment, to improving financing for urban systems, and to using migration storytelling to improving financial literacy. Bruce also served as an emergency responder after September 11th, 2001, the World Trade Center attacks, and he's an Ashoka social entrepreneur. So, Bruce, welcome back to Breaking Banks. Good to have you back on.
Hey, Brett. Thanks. Great to be with you and to hear Rachel's comments. Yeah.
Yeah. And our second guest, our special guest for today is Manu Saadia. Manu is the author of Trekonomics. That's the economics of Star Trek, a book that came out in June. You can check it out on Amazon. We'll tweet that link for you guys as well. And after looking for a book on Star Trek economics and not finding one, he decided to write it. His work's been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, NPR's Marketplace, Business Insider, the New Yorker. He's originally from Paris, France, and he lives and writes in Los Angeles. Manu, welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Doing very well, very well. So let me ask you both, and I'll start with you, Bruce. Can we really have financial institutions that are responsible to shareholders behave ethically? Is that possible?
I think we can. I think they need some different fintech, Brett, some of which you're very familiar with because you're helping to create it, in terms of social fintech. But I'm teaching a class this quarter at Stanford called Ethics of Finance and Financial Engineering. And we use the metaphor of on the floor are the ethical codes of conduct, whether that's for the CFPB or OCC or whomever, or the state regulators. And on the ceiling are the aspirational goals that you can get to, such as being featured in a TED Talk or on Breaking Banks or whatever. And between
that's a great aspiration to have.
Floor, yeah, of course. and between the floor and the ceiling is where students who are learning algorithmic trading, learning these advanced data science techniques at places like Stanford and MIT, blockchain, will live. And they have to, we need a new culture that says, very much like medicine, that your job is to ensure your customers' financial wealth and health, and you're to use all of your creativity toward those goals. And that's a fundamentally different culture, but you need a new form of bank to welcome that culture, to reward that culture than we've been seeing.
Now, Manu, I do have the first question for you. Is
go right
what's
ahead.
What's the current exchange rate of U.S. dollars to gold press latinum? Do you have a?
That is hard to figure out. I remember fielding questions.
Have you ever been asked that question on a radio show before?
I've been asked about the interest rates in the galaxy and the benchmark. And it's obviously the Federation, but since the Federation does not necessarily use money on the inside, well, it's a funny question. And it's true that gold press latinum is a very weird form of currency when you start thinking about it, because it's hard currency. Summarize for the listeners: the gold press latinum is the currency that is used in the galaxy in the Star Trek universe outside of the Federation.
Federation actually doesn't have money, does it? So, where we need to get to have? Do we need to remove money from the system to avoid these sorts of unethical problems with the income equality gap and things like that, Manu?
I wonder. Star Trek seems to think that it's not so much money or currency that is, the point of fixation or the source of all problems, so to speak. But it seems that for one reason or another, and you can see in the book, the Federation and people in Star Trek are obsessed with behaving ethically and doing the right thing in any given situation. Forget the starships and the aliens and all that. It's a show all about ethics. And how they achieve that is probably by solving most of problems of distribution of wealth in society by using this incredible machine called the Replicator. Once you solve the question of imbalances between supply and demand of goods and services, then the necessity to have a market is really curtailed, and whatever is subject to monetary transaction in the Federation is a tiny little bit, and mostly it's transactions that are performed with outside civilization. Personally, I have a certain fondness for currency. I collect bills of various countries. So I think we would lose a lot culturally by removing money. But it has externalities as well. So it's a trade-off. Let's put it that way.
So Bruce, what role does money itself have in sort of skewing ethics in society?
We are looking at tagging money with its intention, very much like Star Trek. So I'm very, it's great to have Manu on. What if you could deposit your money in a bank, declare your intention for solving poverty or reducing health risks, et cetera, let the bank understand how the applications for loans will achieve parts of your intention, and then give you feedback that not only did they lend your money for purposes that included your intentions, but this is how much of that intention was achieved. That might be an interim step towards the Trekonomics conclusions that Matt is describing. Also, the bankers who are the stewards for doing that would develop their own different culture, that's their role, is to be fiduciaries for those impacts.
So let me ask Manu here. There's a lot that sort of gets not said in the Star Trek universe. I remember one of the episodes in Next Generation where they found these people who'd been frozen, cryogenically frozen, and they brought them back. Yeah. And one of the guys was very concerned about what his investments had done. And when they informed him that money didn't exist anymore, then he found it hard to make that adjustment. But people people travel throughout the galaxy. They have homes and apartments. So they sort of gloss over that in the Star Trek universe about how those sort of transactions would take place in a cashless or moneyless society, don't they?
They do. And also, most of what we see on Star Trek is a very small minority of people who have exciting lives, you know, on starships. It seems that life in the Federation, outside of what you see on the show, is fairly pedestrian. And yes, people do have houses. I was kind of wondering what a property title would look like, and what that property even means when, well, everything's pretty much available. I wonder. I mean, it's something that is not explained in the show, and maybe it's this type of cultural inventions that have not yet been made because we're not in that world. I was imagining that maybe there's a sort of Airbnb, a galactic Airbnb, where you can say, I want to live on that planet for 2 years, and you will be matched with someone who intends to go live somewhere else for a while. It seems that that sort of...
the ultimate sharing economy.
Yes, something like that. But is it really sharing, since, you know, you don't really own these assets that you're sharing?
True.
You're just a custodian. So it seems that ownership is more, maybe we could imagine that ownership would be more close to something like, I'm taking care of this apartment or this house or this thing for a little while, and then I need to pass it on to the next person in the state I found it originally. And so everybody becomes a custodian. Idealistic, and it relies on everybody's ethic. And so there's a huge problem of coordination and collective action to attain that type of generalized behavior in society.
You need like this whole group psychology or this total commitment by society to that, which is and that's interesting to see when the Federation reacts with economies that don't have those same values, how they bridge that. And if you're hearing a bit of background noise in the studio today, my 7-year-old son Thomas is sitting here with us. Can you say hello, Thomas?
Hello.
I don't know if you heard him. He said hello, but he's in the studio today keeping me company. He's playing on his iPad. He's having fun. Gents, we were talking about some of the finer points of the elements of economics in the future. And Bruce, as we start to become a spacefaring society, how does that change the way we think about economics, do you think?
Well, we've been researching space banking, or how will we bank in space, for about a year. And a few interesting facts. The space treaties say that space exploration is to be open to all humankind. And if that's to be the case, then obviously it's nice to have high net worth individuals interested in space and governments willing to fund space exploration. But there really needs to be a financial marketplace for space assets. And as I can see it, and this very much goes to what Manu was talking about before the break, you need to understand the indigenous value of assets on the moon or on Mars or in between, and what is the service that they provide to other missions. We're calling that, although it's sort of odd at Stanford, the USC.
What does that stand for?
The USC meaning... what is the useful space convenience of that asset? And so, having launch facilities from the moon at 1/6 the gravity of Earth means that those launch facilities can use 1/6 the propellant, for example, or having water.
That's interesting. So propellant would have a different value because its leverageability would be much higher on the moon.
That's right. And so how do you make sure that the assets that are built in any part of space are available to other missions that want to be in that region of space? And so you very quickly do get yourself into Trekonomics, and what would be the market function that would accelerate investments in space, as well as another factoid for you. 20% of the cost of a space mission goes into insurance. And so whatever you can do to...
Which would have been useful for the Facebook satellite launch the other week.
Sadly,
they were insured. They were insured. Yeah,
they were insured. The Israelis were insured, right, Manu?
Yeah. That's what I read, at least. The manufacturer was insured.
Yeah. You know, I think when you look at the economics of space travel, they've been talking recently, there's a new chief, or recently NASA has a chief economist who is looking at space economics very differently than are we, you know, building a space industry that can provide us just launch services.
So, Manu, in terms of assets like this, in the Star Trek world, there are obviously assets that, and I think someone tried to do the economic calculations of this, what it would cost to build the Star Trek Enterprise in today's terms. But there's some assets that would be worth, you know, a considerable amount in today's world. So how are assets treated in the Star Trek universe?
I think inside the Federation, they have such advanced computers and sensors that there is perfect information, or at least that is how, I mean, you know, that's underneath, that's the plumbing, that's the only way this works. It's like if there is perfect information. So at any moment, everybody knows what is where and what is available and can be shipped somewhere else. That's the only way, by the way, the Federation without money works. I don't see how it could work otherwise. Such a massive thing. But it seems to me that the main, economic asset in the Federation is the people who make it, the people, the citizens. It's humanoid capital. It's the value brought by the scientists who are incredibly numerous. It's the value brought and built over time by the captains of Starfleet and the diplomats. The focus on human creativity as a way to develop the Federation, as a way to continually invent new things, is really what makes the Federation what it is, at least in the Star Trek universe. And I can give you a very striking proof of that. It's Dr. Zimmerman is the guy who invents the medical hologram that you see on Voyager. So he's a real doctor. He's also a cybernetics genius and a programming genius. And the guy is like, he's making it almost in his garage. But his medical hologram that can be on any ship and anywhere is truly a revolutionary thing. So that's also the thing. There is constant innovation in the Federation, thanks to incredible human capital. That's the only way, at least, I can make it work as a sort of consistent economic system. Other than that, what is traded? It's hard to say. I mean, they do trade a lot with the Ferengis and the Outsiders, but it's not really...
It's more a bartering system, right? They're more sort of barter, don't they, when they trade with other economies?
Yes. Yeah, they do the sort of things where you do have a few episodes where they try to make sign treaties with outsiders where they're going to offer, I think with the Cardassian ones, they offer industrial replicators. So can you imagine, you know, that's an asset that's really of value to outsiders, replicator.
You know, in the Star Trek universe, has scarcity disappeared? Is that one of the reasons you can have this sort of
I don't know. I'm conflicted about this.
Utopian society?
The post-scarcity, I mean, it seems that a lot of the necessities, the scarcity of necessity has disappeared. but there is still only one captain's chair. And that is the most highly coveted position in the world. So you don't want to be a captain of industry. You want to be the captain of the enterprise. That's what really is the top position.
Yeah, you don't want to be the number one fintech podcaster in the world. You want to be in the captain's chair.
Exactly. It's the economy of reputation. So that's what's scarce. The positions of honor. Being the best scientist, or being the most recognized diplomat, being Mr. Spock—that's something I was wondering when I was writing the book. It's like, okay, so what does live long and prosper really mean? That's the Vulcan greeting: live long and prosper. What does that mean? Live long, okay, fair enough. You know, technology, we can live long,
but how do you prosper with that? Yeah.
I mean, it's not live long and get filthy rich. It's something else. It's about fulfilling your purpose and being a good person, an ethical person, and try to do your best for your own good, but also for the good of the others. It's something it's really hard to get at. I think also I alluded to that in a piece I wrote for the New Yorker, but it seems that the people on Star Trek are really foreign to us. They're almost like thought experiments, because it's really hard to identify with their moral universe. We just don't live like this today.
It's
very alien.
So let me ask you, Bruce. There's been in Switzerland, we had a recent experiment with a referendum on universal basic income. There's been a lot of discussion about the fact that as we move to highly automated societies and artificial intelligence has impact and so forth, if we get, as a result of those changes in society, large-scale unemployment, about the only thing that could stop large-scale social unrest is a sort of universal basic income. Now, in socialist Europe, this is greeted as a very plausible path, but in the United States and where I'm from in Australia, this is sort of seen with as some of the right-wing politicians are horrified by this suggestion. But would a universal basic income produce a more ethical society economically, do you think?
You know, I'd like to see it studied. I'd like to see some of the research out of Israel, out of some of the Nordic countries. Clearly, there's a lot to be done, Brett, to restore the real economy, to improve health, to get the roads fixed, to grow food that doesn't make people sick. I mean, there's a ton of real work that could be funded by the financial system that could employ people to do things that they're right now unemployed, or they're slack assets. Coming back to Manu's point about the future, we've got people in lots and lots of neighborhoods in decline that have enormous insights into how to improve the conditions there. And so I don't know if it's as much a universal basic income that's needed as you've heard me describe a three-layered map, where we know there are needs in that neighborhood, we know there are solutions that could work in that neighborhood, and we know a lot of money is appropriated to those needs or those solutions, but somehow never gets to the neighborhood. There's a lot of intervening carriers and gatekeepers.
Like the Red Cross building five houses in Haiti.
There you go. And so, you know, could we, and this is something we're working on, could we build a periodic table of quality of life elements? And as you do jobs that create better health or create food that nourishes, or fix declining buildings, you get credit for that, and you instantly get paid for that. So I don't think it's as much a universal basic income question as a universal basic right to a job that means something,
right,
and produces real value.
Well, you know, I think I think it'd be interesting to see jobs that are created, for example, to undo climate change damage. You know, they have real value to society, but, you know, a company is not going to get ROI out of that, right? What's the ROI of saving the planet? So just a quick one.
Yeah, go on.
Just a quick one, Bruce. Our irascible researcher, Mike King, he said the cost to build the USS Enterprise, $479 trillion, or about 13% of the total U.S. defense budget.
So can we start a Kickstarter today?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Manu, can you get on that?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's going to take a while. We won't live to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's wonderful.
So, what do you think in practical terms? I'll ask this to both of you. Manny, you can go first. In practical terms, if we look at the Star Trek world and Trekonomics as the ultimate achievement of mankind economically and financially, a society where no one wants for anything, there's advanced, immediate free healthcare and education through technology available all throughout the world. What are some steps that we can do in the foreseeable future over the next, say, decade or two to get us closer to that utopian ideal?
Well, there's something while researching the book that I found is that this is about public goods. So the type of goods that are freely available to everybody, and my usage of them does not prevent anybody else from using them. So we're talking about things like the internet, which costs almost nothing to access, and the knowledge, that the repository of knowledge that is the internet. That has multiplying effects on education and on standards of living. And we might not see the effects like right away, but in the long run, I believe that this sudden accessibility of scientific knowledge and culture will have tremendous impacts on our society. I also think that developing more of these public goods and making more things available as public goods will probably help us get there. The example that I cite in the book is GPS, so the Global Positioning System. It's actually freely available to anybody. It's maintained at a cost of $1 billion a year or so by the Department of Defense, and it's for the good of humanity. And look at the value this has created. And I'm not just talking about Uber or Google Maps or Waze. GPS helps scientists actually find out patterns in settlement patterns in plant and vegetation and agricultural production. It has changed the way we look at the world and the way we live in this planet for the better. So more of these things probably, like GPS, probably will help us advance towards a future that is more where distribution of wealth and opportunity is more equal, and probably that is more beneficial for everybody. Going into space to create these sort of things and to have more data about the world and more shareable data about the world is really the right way to go.
Well, so we can start on the planet. We're starting to see now Google and Facebook look at deployment of artifacts in Africa for wireless and internet connectivity. We're developing mesh networking technology, stuff like that, 3D printing. There's a bunch of stuff that we could apply right here and now or over the next few years that could make it more of an equal playing field. If a farmer in Kenya can sell his goods over his mobile phone to someone on the other side of the world, then this is certainly going to produce higher quality of living across the planet.
I've talked to people at Google, after the book came out, some people reached out to me, and some of the people, an engineer reached out to me, they told me that their company, Google, is actually, there are people at Google who really think deep, long, and hard about these things and want to make it happen. And that's why they're developing Android, at a cost of almost nothing. So yes, they skim off the top by, pushing ads. But the benefit they provide to the rest of humanity is incommensurably higher than the kind of value they capture for themselves. And Google is doing that. I don't know anybody at Facebook, but I believe there are people, it's probably the same. It's the same culture. So
maybe Bruce, maybe once they do finally launch their satellite, they can change their name to Spacebook. So Bruce,
only if Zuckerberg wears tights.
Red tights, yes. Ensign expendable. So Bruce, what do you think? What do we can do over the next 10, 20 years to create a more sustainable financial ecosystem?
So I think there's an internal and external piece, and we've been talking about it. One is we've got to fix the valuation methods for seeing value created beyond the Bloomberg screen. The financial markets do not tell us much about the real economy, how people are healthy or poor or any of that. So we need much better data in a useful form to know how companies and governments are accountable for the real economy that they're supposed to grow. And that will go a long way. The other thing is we need to train a whole cohort of bankers and financial engineers and regulators and insurers in that real economy data science so that they can actually fund at a price in the right amount at the right time for the right borrower or target company that you're investing in, the activity that does grow the real economy. And
yeah,
the tools diagnosing what do we need in that realm.
Okay. So listen, guys, we're running out of time. We've got about 90 seconds before the close. So I want to give Manu a proper opportunity to give his book a plug. Manu, where can we find Trekonomics?
Well, you can find it at your local bookstore or on Amazon. It is also available as an audiobook.
And Bruce, where can we find out about the Good Bank and the Sustainable Banking Initiative?
The easiest is to have folks go on Twitter at Bruce Cahan.
So, I think, we've got a lot to think about in the future, but the future, I'm an optimist. Manu, are you an optimist about the future when it comes to for the financial system and economics?
I'm terribly pessimistic. That's why I wrote the book.
Really?
To cure myself.
Did it cure you?
Yeah.
Bruce, are you optimistic?
Yeah, I am. I am. I see Stanford students from all over the world, all of whom could qualify as Star Trek cast members. And it makes you pretty optimistic being around them.
Very cool.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity. This podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Back to Breaking Banks. Again, this is Sam Mall stepping in for Brett King today. Also, we have Mark Hochstein from American Banker. And our next guest is one that I'm extremely proud to spend the next 20 minutes or so speaking with. This is John Hope Bryant. John has founded multiple companies and multiple organizations such as Global Dignity, the Hope Project. And I think what I found to be fascinating is American Banker actually selected John as their Innovator of the Year when it comes to banking. And Mark, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that and how you guys came about in that selection process.
Yeah, it's an unusual pick for an award like that. You know, usually it would be someone on the technology side, you know, someone like our usual host, Brett, But you don't have to, you know, not all innovation is technological. And I think the interesting, one of the interesting things for us about John's story and Operation Hope is that he has found an approach to financial literacy that is deeply integrated into the business of banking and into business development and into customer acquisition. And I'll let John explain in detail, but it's not only tackling the social problem of financial literacy and financial inclusion, it's also at the same time addressing a couple business problems for banks, one of which is customer acquisition, and the other is simply keeping the physical retail bank branch relevant. I'm sure that when Brett hears this, he's going to he's going to be shocked that we're talking about bank branches as being something that is relevant in this world. But I think John's got a really interesting approach. John, do you want to talk a little bit about Hope Inside and how it works? And
sure. First of all, Mark, thank you, and Sam, everybody, thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be. I received the Time Magazine 50 Leader for the Future Award and the Oprah Winfrey Use Your Life Award and so on and so forth. But frankly, this is my most important award. It's a little sort of mini Nobel Peace Prize in the space of what I do in the field that's most important in an industry that is not used to systemic change from outsiders and in a way that is acceptable to the insiders, that is still morally grounded and ethical, and it sort of rings all the bells. It's a combination of everything in my life into one breath. And I think the way to summarize this, Mark and Sam, is to say nothing changes your life more than maybe God or love than moving your credit score 120 points.
That is a fantastic quote. I've loved that.
And while that sounds wonderful, it's also a business case. Because if somebody has a 500 credit score, be they black and brown urban or be they white rural, they're not a customer for banks. They are a prime customer for the $1 trillion alternative financial services industry. But they're not a customer for banks. And I wanted to help get the banks out of the no business and back into the yes business, which is a business that they want to be in, but for a range of reasons, can't get there on their own. So the culmination of this, to cut to the chase, if you will, is hope inside of bank branches, hope inside of grocery stores, hope inside of big box retailers, houses of faith, government offices. We even have hope inside of Whole Foods, hope inside of two Hyatt hotels, where people stop, shop, and flock. Becoming the private banker to the working poor, the struggling class, the teetering middle class, people with too much month at the end of their money, expanding the marketplace and creating a business development tool for mainstream institutions that want to do well and do good, getting banking back in the moral business, making banking a moral calling once again.
So, John, you've got advisors, counselors stationed inside these bank branches, and they're there to counsel people who are not yet ready to be banked.
Correct. Maybe they weren't ready. Maybe they were ready. They were in the banking system and got bounced out after 2009. So these are not necessarily poor people. Many of our people are, there's 134 million stressed out Americans who are living from paycheck to paycheck. They're in both of our family, by the way, in all three of our families. We know them. We all have a cousin Boo-Boo, by the way, who's asking you for a loan, sleeping on your couch, but also it's somebody who got laid off in 2009. They were making $80,000 a year, laid off 2009, got a job 18 months later, 2011, making $50,000 a year. So they're employed, but they're underemployed, and they're stressed out, and they're ashamed. They're ashamed to admit that the world's not working for them, that they're not the success that they have told their children, that they profess to their wife or their husband, and they don't know who to turn to. They have nobody to talk to. So private banking is no longer for the wealthy. I don't need a private banker. I've got one. I've got my cell phone. That's my private banker. I don't have a self-esteem problem or a confidence issue. I'm not depressed. But most people today are depressed. They've lost hope. They feel they feel like they're batting for themselves. And that showed up in the election, by the way. And so you have really cratering jobs, economic fear, that's driving now the political process and driving the desperation in our lives. And I think that having a private banker for the average person in this bank branch that can help to sit with them and walk them through out of their challenges and back into their opportunities or reintroducing them back to themselves is a wonderful thing for everybody. The unbanked, the could-be banked, the near banked, the once-was banked, I got slammed by a bank. I mean, you're really rejuvenating the American democracy and returning her back to her original idea.
And from the bank's point of view, so they're giving some space to your organization inside their retail locations.
Which helps with CRA.
It helps with the Community Reinvestment Act credit, but it goes beyond that.
Of course. And I'm just saying they're just checking a lot of boxes. I've got 29 federal designations. So whatever box you want to check, I've got it pre-checked for you. I'm like the Starbucks of financial inclusion. but what I'm really doing, I mean, at SunTrust Banks, SunTrust recently ordered 200 locations. You don't order 200 locations of Hope Inside because it's a nice thing to do, because it's sweet. We went from 6 locations to 200 because they had a 464% increase in bank referrals year over year. And I want your audience to listen to that number again, because that number almost never shows up in banking legally. I mean, a 20% return or increase in anything would be super impressive. I'm sure you both would agree.
Yeah, John, I got a question for you. So I watched in researching you a little bit, you know, and reading, you know, the award from American Banker. I went on YouTube, and you got me ready to walk through a brick wall right now. Incredibly pumped up. In one of your videos, you make this statement: "There's a difference between broke and being poor." Can you expand on that just a little bit? What did you mean by that?
I mean that we've gotten poverty all wrong.
Yep.
Which is why we can't solve it. There's a difference between being broke and being poor. Being broke is economic, but being poor is a disabling frame of mind, a depressed condition of your spirit, and you must vow never, ever, ever to be poor again. So here's poverty. Poverty is half low self-esteem and low confidence in yourself. If you don't know who you are by 9 in the morning, by dinner time, somebody's going to tell you who you are. Try doing this radio program without confidence and self-esteem. Try being the editor of the American Banker without confidence and self-esteem. Try being the producer, the young lady across from me, without confidence and self-esteem. Try raising your children. Your children will run over you without confidence and self-esteem. You can't do anything. You can't drive on the freeway without confidence and self-esteem. But if you're black in America and you have 250 years of slavery and 100 years of Jim Crow ending in 1970, and you've been told you ain't crap for 350 years, you actually believe it. I think that 70% of black Americans clinically undiagnosed depressed. Now, if you've lived in rural America in 50 years, you've seen factories die, no economic growth, no prosperity, no financial dignity, your self-esteem is taking a dump. And I can go on the 2009 economic crisis. Has that ruled your confidence level? Then you've got the second part of poverty, crappy role models and a crappy environment. So everybody's aspirational. But if all I see is symbols of success in my neighborhood are rap stars, athletes, and drug dealers, then why is anybody surprised that I grew up wanting to emulate a rap star, an athlete, or a drug dealer? It's actually quite rational. You're modeling what you see. Environment. You hang around 9 broke people, you'll be the 10th. The last part is aspiration and opportunity. Aspiration is a code word for hope. The most dangerous person in the world is a person with no hope. So here you have America today. Crappy self-esteem and crappy confidence. Crappy role models and a crappy environment. No hope, which means no sense of opportunity, which means you end up in the no business, not in the yes business. It means you're expert in what you're against, not what you're for. You're not skeptical, you're cynical. You don't believe in institutions, you don't even believe in yourself. You're depressed. That's poverty. You've got to re-engineer that. You've got to reverse design that, because the economy's people. America's not a country, she's an idea. And we can make her anything we want. And we can let her devolve and drift into oblivion. Or we can reclaim our democracy every day like it's a job. And I think that we're sitting in a moment in history right now. But history doesn't feel historic when you're sitting in it. It feels like another day. So if this is an economic crisis, and I think it is, if this is a GDP and jobs crisis, then how do you reverse engineer that? Well, I need infrastructure. I need systems and I need platforms. If I'm going to do it for young people, it's going to be in schools. I have a whole other platform that I'm going to launch 1,000 locations in inner city schools to create entrepreneurs and small business owners and internships in schools. Because Steve Jobs came from a school. All these Facebook founders, all this stuff came from schools, in many cases left school because the school wasn't speaking to them. That's a whole other topic for another day, right? But what would have happened, by the way, if we had left Steve Jobs drift? Think about that.
Yeah.
Think about if that little Syrian, the child of a Syrian immigrant, we dismissed them. The world would literally, we'd be rock, paper, scissors today, right? That's a whole other topic. So for adults, how do you affect that? The banking system. You cannot have a modern economy without the banking system. But the banking system is not designed today to speak to the least of these God's children. There's no malice there. They mean well, but they can't get there by themselves. So I decided to become a national credit enhancement and build GDP and customer acquisition. In other words, now I'm not saying to bankers, help me help poor people. No, because half my clients are middle class. I'm saying, how do I help you achieve your strategic objectives? And I'm doing it at scale, 1,000 locations by 2020. And I'm going to finish what Abraham Lincoln started in 1865 with the Freedmen's Bank, where he chartered a bank to teach free slaves about money, which nobody knows about.
So, John, I'm looking at your Wikipedia page. I love that I can say that I'm talking to somebody where I'm looking at their Wikipedia page. Mark, I'm sure I'll create a page for you after this. But here's what I find interesting. We were born the same year. I was born in Detroit.
Yeah.
You're from Compton, right?
You were born. It was the richest city in America, richest city in the world.
Yeah. And then riots about 5 years later, which is, you know, tells you a lot about the, you know, the environments that
they
we
lost
grew up
their storyline too.
Exactly. So here's what I'm curious about. And I always loved the of the idea, and in reading and some of the things about you is that this came out of this evolved after the riots in L.A. Can you touch on that? What's the birth story? Where'd the idea come from for this?
Well, I'll try to keep this short so I can answer your what I call your more left-brain questions about how this works, which I'm sure are coming. But, you know, I grew up in South Central L.A. in Compton, California, where we didn't ever heard of the word entrepreneur. I didn't see anybody with a suit on. My mother told me she loved me every day of my life, so never had a self-esteem problem. My dad owned his own business, so he wore a suit. So he wore a suit. I wanted to be a businessman to wear a suit. I modeled what I saw. And then a banker came in my classroom when I was 9, Mark and Sam, and taught me a course in financial literacy. Now, he happened to be Caucasian, but for me, he was green, the color of currency. And I asked him, sir, what do you do for a living, and how'd you get rich legally? He said, I'm a banker and I finance entrepreneurs. I said, I don't know what an entrepreneur is, but if you're financing them, I want to be one. Well, that led to my first business, the neighborhood candy house in Compton, California, where I put the liquor store out of the candy business, making $300 a week when I was 10 years old. That was the birth of an entrepreneur. And I figured out that the real problem was poverty in my neighborhood. How do I unpack poverty and repack it with poor people in mind? Then I built a business, $0 to $24 million, bought my employer, blah, 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 that was now 23, 24, 25 years old. And I'm living the dream. And then we have the riot in 1992. And I thought racism was dead because I had made it. And I didn't realize that I had a gift that my peers in my neighborhood didn't have. And it was what I just explained to you. And so I decided to make a difference. And I founded Operation Hope after the riots, but I had a different approach, which was to use the free enterprise system to set people free. And it's taken me 22 years from that date when my first budget was $61,000. I'll do $45 million in revenue this year. But it's taken me, you know, it took me 22 years to come upon this new software that had all the elements in it. And it's taken me 25 years, it's 25th year anniversary next year, to sort of be reborn as a startup that I think can has real impact to fulfill my original vision, which was to change the world.
And let's talk about that. A couple of years ago, Operation Hope changed its business model. Can you talk about that and describe what the model is now and how you pivoted?
Yeah, and I'm only going to mention the name because you actually put it in your magazine, so I don't have to feel like I'm demeaning anybody. God bless them. E-Trade was a benefactor of us for years on our old model. They changed CEOs often, and this last CEO was trying to save money. Well, we were an easy line item. And the joke I heard was the new CEO said, if you talk to John Bryan, he's going to separate you from your wallet. So just say no. It was a compliment about, I guess, my ability to persuade. So they just decided to take me out of the budget. And it was a gift. First of all, I thank them for all the support. It was a decade of support. But it caused me to rethink my business plan. I mean, I wanted to fire myself because I thought I was a failure. But we had 9 offices across the country. None of them were sustainable. All of them were big boxes, and they basically blinked, you know, a bright light of poverty, which means not only even poor people don't want to be seen as poor, right? So nobody wanted to come in my offices. And so in some ways they did me a favor. I found one office that was working, which was Bank of the West in Oakland. It was a co-located office. We were inside their branch. And there wasn't that energy. There wasn't that negative connotation. In fact, we had the flow of their customers coming to us. But we weren't working with the bank. We were working alongside the bank. So I said, let's take the thing that's working, see if we can amplify it, and close the things that aren't. That was a birth of hope inside. So never let a crisis go to waste, was my theory.
And now describe the model that you're sticking with.
So we're the Starbucks of financial inclusion. You walk in the bank branch. It's like going into Target and you see Starbucks to the right. You walk into the bank branch, every office is HUD certified, SBA certified, FDIC certified. All the regulators have blessed us being in the bank branch. We have the Office of Trade and the Patent and Trade Office. We have all these certifications, CFPB, all the regulators. In fact, we're the only nonprofit allowed by the regulators to be in a bank branch. You come in, unfortunately, you have a 550 credit score. You take an application. The bank's not going to tell you you're going to be declined. They can't, by law or risk management, they'll let you go through the entire process, then tell you at the end, with good intentions, you can't be, you know, you're denied. You normally walk out the door angry. The bank manager says, can you go talk to that person over there? Just trust me. They come talk to us. We sit down. We say, Mrs. Jones, can we pull your credit? Now, the banker's not going to do that. But we don't work for the bank. Sure. We pull the credit. Is this yours? I don't know what that is. Now, if you have a 550 credit score, you've never checked your credit. Because if you check your credit, you will not have a 550 credit score. Because I guarantee you there's an error on your credit. 90% of Americans with that credit level has an error on their credit. Is this yours? No. Can we dispute it? Yes. What's that mean? That means that if you dispute an error and the credit bureaus can't confirm it in 30 days, they must remove it. So she gets that removed. What happens to her self-esteem? Goes way up. Her confidence goes way up. Her belief in the system. Oh, my God. What does that mean? 40-point pop. So now she goes from 540 credit score to 580. Her shoulders go back. She's, okay, now what? Okay, come back in 2 weeks. Is this yours? Yeah, that's mine. That's a charge-off. It was $1,000 of a phone bill. 10 years ago, it was a divorce. Okay, we got to deal with this. It's SBC purchased by SBC purchased by Packet Bell, purchased by AT&T. Now, Joe's Finance Company owns the debt. Can we call him? Sure. We call Joe's Finance Company. He bought it for $50. What do you want from it? We wanted $100. I'll tell you the story. What do you want for it? We want $100. Okay. How about $200? Well, why would you pay me more? Because if I pay you more, you're going to give me your cell phone number, your email address, and you're going to write a letter to the credit bureaus. In 30 days, the credit bureaus seriously drop it off the credit again, right? You're going to write another letter to the credit bureaus because I'm going to overpay you. So you get 100% profit, and she gets an 80% discount. Deal? Deal. Her credit score goes up another 30 points. Now she's in the 600s. She's 610. Man, she's feeling great. Now she's willing to do the work. We get her up to 645 credit score. We walk her across the hall to the bank branch. It took 90 days. She gets approved for a 4% mortgage for $140,000 to become a homeowner in Memphis, Tennessee. That's a real story. The banker got a customer. The city got a taxpayer. The family got a stakeholder in financial dignity. She now feels she's part of the free enterprise system. She's got her life back. Now she kicks the bum out of her house who's been abusing her, but she's been hanging around him for money in reliance, which is why women hang around abusive men. And the story goes on and on and on. Now she's telling her kid, you know what, baby? Don't just go get a job. Create a job. Why don't you become an entrepreneur? Look at what I've done. See what you can do. See, all the lights now come on in the city.
Hey, John, I want to ask, I always like to kind of wrap up with the what's next question, but you alluded to it, so I want to drill in on it. I'm a history major, so the second you went there, I started high-fiving myself. You said you wanted to fulfill that dream of the Freedmen's Bank that Lincoln actually kind of talked about. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so Secretary Jack Lew, I went to him last year and said, you know that the Freedmen's Bank was located at the Treasury Annex Building across from the White House, across from Treasury. He didn't know. Nobody knows it. It was a bank that Lincoln created after the Civil War to try to bring America back and to introduce the free enterprise system to former slaves, to let them become owners. 2 months before that, you had what we call 40 acres and a mule. So he's literally trying to finance the land and the inventory for the crops of former slaves to get them, make them capitalists. He was killed the next month. So the story is lost to history, but it was 73,000 former slaves with $52 million in deposits, $100 billion today without another dime, run by Frederick Douglass, who was a businessman who we know as an abolitionist, who put up $10,000 of his own money, $20 million today, as a stakeholder. So this is what, I mean, this is a wonderful story. And a black man, Frederick Douglass, working with a white conservative politician, Lincoln, to make America great in a true way again, right? So, and I didn't do that on purpose, by the way. And the story was lost to history. 100 years later, 150 years later, I go to Secretary Lew, rename the building. You must be crazy. Attorneys say, you know, you're not a congressman, you're not a senator. No, I'm an American with a dream. You can't do it. Try. They figure out you can do it administratively. January 7th, building renamed, Freedman's Bank Building. Look it up on your computer,
Bob. Oh, yeah.
And then I said, well, this has to be more than symbolism. We got to move from civil rights to civil rights, from a movement in the streets to a movement in the suites, about class and poverty, not race and the color line. We've got to move in a space where we're all in this thing together. Not white, black, red, brown, and yellow race, but green. Economics. And I want to create a vision that's finished with Lincoln started. Black men and white men and women working together to set America on a new course, and that's a Thousand Hope and Side location. So I'm going to finish what Lincoln started. By year 2020, we will have a Thousand Hope and Side locations. We will raise credit scores to 700 because 700 credit score communities don't riot. You've never seen a 700 credit score community riot in America's history of any race. All the problems are in 500 credit score neighborhoods, black and brown and white. So, and we rural do this, we'll create urban. Customers. Excuse me?
Rural and urban.
Rural and urban. Exactly. And that was the, quote, riot at the ballot box that we just experienced, was people saying, I've got cratering jobs, I've got financial stress, and I'm losing hope, and I'm depressed. And I don't know what my future looks like, and I'm scared. And that's no way to, for a first-run nation like America to lead. And so I think that common people can do uncommon things. And I think this is the next leg of the movement. And when you do this, I think you'll create entrepreneurs and small business owners. You'll create homeowners and stakeholders who, by the way, vote. When you're a stakeholder, you vote. You create taxpayers and a tax base, which inspires local stakeholders and local creates tax bases for cities so they can have better schools and better policing, so better infrastructure. It's a hand-up strategy, not a hand-out strategy. I don't know. I mean, look, America was created by poor people. You know, Goldman Sachs was a guy named Goldman and a guy named Sachs. Walmart was Sam Walton with a pickup truck, a storefront, and a high school education. Don't tell me what we cannot do.
And I'll tell you, folks, don't bet against this guy. Don't bet against the organization. John, where can we learn more about Operation Hope?
OperationHope.org.
And there you go, folks. That is so simple. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
That was John Hope Bryant. And the first segment was with Manu Saadi and Bruce Kahan. I hope that you enjoyed our last show of the year. A big thank you to our sponsor, Temenos. Please check them out at temenos.com and look for news about their innovation jams. Please remember to follow the show on Twitter at BreakingBanks1. If you like the show, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps more people find the show. Also, make sure that you subscribe to Sam Mall's podcast, The FinTech 5, which you can find at fintech5.com or iTunes or anywhere you listen to podcasts. And check out Consult Hyperion's Tomorrow's Transactions podcast with Dave Birch. Dave interviews some of the best and brightest in fintech, and he is one of the funniest men in the business. Thank you all for being with us at Breaking Banks. We wish you all a very happy 2017.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.